number two of the Bible study. I'm Chuck Rather. Thank you for tuning our way. This is the Ask the Pastor Hour, 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. It's an open phone program, so you can ask pretty much whatever question you would like to ask. Just give us a call at that number, and we'll be happy to get you on the radio. Number again, 505-7850-1-800-730-2727.
No! Oh, there goes Luther.
Hit his thumb again. That thumb ought to be flat by now. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727 will also work for you if you are looking to get in the drawing. We have over 100 entries here. We just started the contest this week. Over 100 entries already in the drawing for the Lutheran Study Bible. So if you want to get your name in the hopper, based on the hammering on the church door in Wittenberg there, I'd say this is a good time to do it. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Sally will take your name and address, your contact information, should you happen to be one of the winners, when on Friday, October 30th, we draw 7 prizes, 4 Lutheran Study Bibles and 3 grand prizes of the Lutheran Study Bible and also the Daily Treasury of Prayer, the 2 volumes together to 3 folks who will win on Friday, October 30th. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727 if you'd like to get your name in the hopper. Let's say good morning and welcome to our guest here in this hour, Pastor Alan Shade of Emmanuel Lutheran Church in St. Charles. Good morning, Pastor.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm fine.
Is the Missouri River getting higher and higher?
It does. Of course, it comes a long way, all the way from Montana, so it has a lot of chance to pick up some fluids.
Does the river ever, when it's high, does it ever threaten the area that you're in down there? You ever have high water down there?
The highest it came in 1993 during the flood was across Frontier Park and up almost to Main Street. It did not get to Main Street, and we're up from there. So I think we're relatively safe at Emmanuel.
Oh, okay, good. Well, you may be safe from the river, Pastor, but you're not safe from the Ask the Pastor show here. I've got a listener warning kind of a thing here that we got to do that I'd like to talk about with you. Would use some video here, and of course, for our purposes, it'll be audio that I'd like you to listen to. I'm gonna pull my head out of the sand here and take a look around and see what's actually going on in what we call American Christianity, and see if we can't share some thoughts here. This is a piece of audio from ABC News. It's an interview with a former punk rocker who has now become a pastor.
Praise the Lord.
And he has written a book called 10 Things I Hate About Christianity. Does that cause you to stroke your chin a little bit and think, okay, the guy's a pastor.
I never know quite where you find these things for me, Chuck, but I knew it's going to be interesting.
Well, I'm just going to warn everybody. I'm going to keep the volume down here a little bit as we start this audio, because we're going to hear the punk rocker pastor's past. And, if you are a music lover, unless you really love punk rock, you're probably not going to be all that excited about the music you're going to hear. But let's listen, you and I and our listeners, to the first part of this interview, and then maybe we can ask some questions. You ready?
Sure.
Here we go.
Jason Berggren used to sing, if you want to call it singing, with an influential Christian hardcore punk band called Strong Arm. He then went on to become a pastor with some very strong views on his faith. In fact, he has written a controversial new book called 10 Things I Hate About Christianity. Hate is a pretty strong word.
So I've heard. Hate is a strong word, and I really wrestled with using the term. I batted the idea back and forth with a few friends and acquaintances, and they were always on both sides. Some said, can't you use the, like, really, really don't like? And others were like, you can only think of 10 things you hate about Christianity. I think I've got about 30 right now in my mind. So in the end, I decided that I use the term, the context I use the term is a honest, open, passionate expression. It's a deep-ridden, angst-ridden frustration that can propel you towards forward momentum. It's not a closed, bitter anger. It might be a lot, maybe not you, but on New Year's Day, I always wake up and look at myself in the mirror and say, I hate the way you look, Jason. And I start making resolutions. And so I kind of use it in that context.
It's like a little piece of sand in an oyster.
Yeah, that's right. Someone said like a burr in your saddle. I've never ridden a horse, so I don't know. I think your expression is maybe better. Or like when you get that little piece of rock in your shoe. So yeah, absolutely.
Let's go through the list. I have the
okay.
book. Heavily marked up version of the book.
Oh,
right
good.
Here. It seems like you're touching the third rail when you say you hate the Bible.
Yeah, well, that's a big one. But, you know, I lay out the foundation, the 10 foundational things that in the 20 years that I've had faith that are just kind of reoccurring things for me and observations I see in other people's lives, too. And so the Bible is one of those. So it's not I have to hit on all cylinders. It's not untouchable.
Right. What do you hate about the Bible?
Well, I go through a bunch of things, and one of the things, for example, is that early on I found the Bible boring. And a lot of that had to do with the translation of the Bible I was given, which was a King James Version. If you like the King James Version, great. I mean, I don't really care. And a lot of people get bogged down, and you got to read this translation, and that's what happened to me. But, you know, we've never had personal Bibles until relatively modern times. And so somehow the message of Jesus survived all that time. I think to get hung up on translation is not a big deal. So that's one of the things.
All right, Pastor Shade, what are your initial reactions to what you heard?
Probably two. First, that the sensationalism is something that I tend to associate with punk rock anyway. So the use of sensationalism in order to be heard is a communication attempt that a lot of people use in modern day, because if you just speak in traditional ways or ways people used to hearing, they often turn you off. So maybe he's trying to reach some people that are only attracted to sensationalist stuff, and to say he hates the Bible and then water it down by saying he's bored with a particular translation is kind of a bait and switch approach. So doesn't sound like he hates the Bible. He just was forced to use a translation he doesn't agree with. So I don't like the style, but it's almost the same old, same old. I hate to say it, but pardon the pun, but when you come across that way and then you have such a weak, sissy kind of comment to follow it up, it's not really
sissy
being very faithful.
Sissy kind of comment?
Well, tell me, Chuck, this is the first time you've ever had somebody say that a particular translation or parts of the Bible are boring? I mean, how long have you heard that?
Well, forever.
Forever, so he's not saying anything new. And the translation's been around for 400 plus, almost 500 years now. So I would have thought somebody along the way would have accused the King James translation of having some boring parts.
So, you know, it would be helpful if you and our listeners could see the video. Can't do that because this is radio. But we've got a young man here. And he claims now to have been a Christian for 20 years. And I'm thinking to myself, his path to wherever he is now, serving as a pastor, having a congregation, if you could see the video, you could see that this interview with the ABC News reporter is being shot in a situation where he's sitting in a pew. So it looks like a church kind of setting. And I ask myself, I wonder what it is about his path that put him where he is and how that compares to the path that Alan Shade is on, for example, serving as a pastor at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in St. Charles. I don't think the two of you are in proximity in your locations within American Christianity. Would that be a fair assumption?
True, but then you think of the path that a lot of the disciples took that, let's see, some of the backgrounds. Matthew was a tax collector. Paul was a persecutor of the church. Those were some pretty odd characters that would have raised some eyebrows if people had said, you're going to make whom our pastor? So Jesus had a way of calling people from a wide variety of backgrounds and making the backgrounds either usable because they made him, it made it easier to connect with people, or making it irrelevant because the grace of God was the profound thing that, that was the source of transformation.
So you are arriving at the conclusion that the book, The 10 Things I Hate About Christianity, is a kind of a punk rock approach to sensationalizing something that might turn out to be a bait and switch kind of a book? Is that what I heard you say?
Well, you're pushing me to assume conclusions that aren't fair since I've only heard one snippet from the thing. But, yeah, I don't even want to blame punk rock for this. This just seems to me as though he's trying to reach a particular segment, so he's taking a sensationalist approach in hopes that the people to whom he feels a deep calling are more likely to listen.
Did you hear the music there in the beginning of the piece?
It would not be something that I would want to turn on my radio on a regular basis.
I know that Emmanuel St. Charles has a rather large Lutheran school.
We do.
And that you have a whole bunch of kids over there who compete in athletics in your middle school. Boys and girls playing basketball and volleyball and doing all that stuff. As a sports official, I see kids come into gymnasiums. They're getting ready to play basketball or whatever. They all come streaming in their Emmanuel, uniforms or regalia. And what's your color over there? You guys are
blue and white.
You guys
blue and gray.
All right. And it seems like 90% of the kids have iPods or something. They all have headphones on. They're not really talking to anybody. They're just all listening to their music. Now, if you got kids at Emmanuel Lutheran and you knew, Pastor, that they were listening to that punk rock on their way to play at the Christian basketball game, would you be troubled by that?
Depends on what the punk rock was. If it's punk rock Christian music, I'd have a little bit more of a tolerance for it. If it's punk rock and some of the other avenues and directions and content that I bump into from time to time, I would be far less excited about it. I'd be trying to figure out why they were doing it.
You sound like a tolerant man. I think some people might have said, there's some people somewhere, maybe not many left, who would say, well, I would confiscate that iPod. And I would check it out, and I would force my child to get rid of every single piece of music that sounded like that, whether it's Christian or not. How would you react to that?
There may be times when that's necessary, but I think kids are pretty resourceful at countermeasuring those kinds of attempts. So you take one iPod and they replace it with three more. You delete one piece of music from your iPod, and they find 17 sources where they can download what you don't want them to have. There are ways to overcome that, I'm sure, with useful processes, but there are better ways than what I hear you suggesting. So,
all right, let's pick up the interview and continue listening.
It seems to me that by admitting that you find the Bible boring and that often in praying you feel like nobody's listening, You're saying the unmentionable.
Yeah, but I think we need to be honest. I mean, if there's any hope that the message of Jesus is going to have in this modern day, it's got to come through people who are authentic. And I'm not claiming to be authentic, but I'm trying to be. And so that's my hope, that I think I'm really talking about things that everybody is talking about.
Or thinking about.
I once heard this expression, and that is that if a pastor would make a list of all the things he doesn't want to talk about, he'd figure out what everyone else is always talking about. And so
what's your reaction to that comment?
He didn't get to a specific point that I have much of a reaction. The role of a pastor is to find where people are hurting and to find a way to connect to that, and the role of a communicator who wants to preach the gospel, to have a prophetic role in the in society, is to build bridges of communication with people. There's a danger that we've often talked about in the church that I don't know if I should say young pastors fall into, but sometimes parishioners and parishes fall into. They want people to measure up to a certain standard before they are willing to welcome them into their midst. And they want the person outside of the faith to make all the adjustments and make all the changes and reach a certain level before they're willing to engage them. I think that's a little self-righteous, because we're expecting behavior out of people that they don't even have the grace of God in their lives to transform them to make that behavior. So our job is to reach out to them. If what he's doing is trying to build communication bridges to people that are not as likely to be evangelized by more traditional churches, then it needs to be done.
All right, just a little bit more audio here.
I think that really captures the essence of what I'm talking about. So I think it's important just to be honest.
So the goal of coming up with a book with a provocative title like The 10 Things I Hate About Christianity is actually to prod people into a more authentic faith.
Yeah, I want to challenge people who call themselves Christians and their representation. And I also want to pique the curiosity of those that don't.
But there are people who are angry at you about this title.
Yeah, I get emails periodically.
Do you care if people are mad?
I do to a degree, but, you know, you have to be true to your passion and your vision. And so it's not that I want to be disrespectful, but I've got to be true to the vision that's in my heart and present it. So I do get emails about how I'm not supposed to hate, and people quoting the Bible and giving me lessons on, you know, how bad hate is. And it's ironic because the emails are very short and kind of mean and so
hateful.
So it is a kind of a humorous, it's a sense of irony there.
Yeah, a little bit of it.
All right, anything there catch your interest?
Well, I kind of agree with him. And the one of the things that bothers me about Christians is that we're supposed to love our enemies, and I don't think that he's an enemy, but sometimes when Christians respond to the people out there, they give Christianity a bad name by being unkind, heartless, no room for dialogue, you know, judgmental about the process. We need to condemn sin, but some of what he's reacting to is not condemnation of sin. It's judgment about a person's attitude and character and an unwillingness to reach out to them. It's somewhat the dialogue that Jesus would have with the Pharisees, who would step away from people and not be willing to come near and touch people, and the way the Pharisees reacted to Jesus when he was known as a friend of prostitutes and sinners, and you hear the judgment at beginning at chapter 15 in Luke, where Jesus is a guest of people in people's homes, and the Pharisees and the religious leaders come to the disciples and say, how can you follow a guy that associates with those kinds of people? So Jesus tells three parables about the lost and his role as the one who's come to seek and to save the lost, including a father's love for a scallywag son who went off and, I think, didn't he join a punk rock band or something like that?
Yeah, the pig feeders, I think that was called.
Oh, that's what he was. Yeah. Okay.
Well, now comes a very interesting question. It's at least interesting to me. And that is, apparently he heard from people who emailed him and took him to task for using the word hate in his title, 10 Things I Hate About Christianity. And it seemed like the implication was that if there's hate involved, then that's wrong. You've crossed a boundary there. If you're hating, then that's wrong. But that's complicated by Jesus' words where he says, unless you hate mother and father more than me, unless you hate son and daughter, I can't quote it exactly, but you remember that passage.
Well, it's Luke 14. 15. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple.
Well, then maybe there is a different way to approach the word hate in the title, 10 Things I Hate About Christianity, if we use the Luke 14 lens to take a look at it. What do you think?
Well, I think it's as helpful a lens. Not given, I'm still pretty limited information about what he hates, but that would be one of the lenses you would want to use. Now, you do have Old Testament context in which God is pretty firm about some of the behavior that he hates in people and the kinds of attitudes that he has towards idols and idolatry and the people who practice that. But the context of Jesus, most of the time when people preach that Luke 14 text, they say, now wait a second, of course God gave the gift of father and mother and wife and children, they're gifts of God to be received with thanksgiving. They simply are not to be loved more or to usurp the place of God so that you're violating First Commandment practices. So, again, the context is going to dictate that, and I don't know what else he hates.
Well, let's find out what Pastor Shade hates. Let's say that you've got a young couple who just had a brand-new baby. Their parents are very prominent members at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in St. Charles, and they come to you to get the baby baptized. So you agree to do that, but you say, now I'm going to need you to, we're going to have to work through what this means, and so we all understand what's going on here. And you tell them it's important for them to bring the baby back to church and to be faithful in worship and to see to it that the baby will have an education in the faith down the road. And they say, yes, yeah, we'll do all that. We understand, yeah, we promise to do that. And then you don't see them again. 4 years later, here they are in your office with baby number two. They want a baptism. Do you hate that?
I'm not sure why I would put that particular word in there, but it breaks my heart to see it because I know the damage that it can do, and I think there are some passages from Matthew 18 about people responsibility for bringing up children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, and they're neglecting or damaging little ones to do that. So in a sense, I hate that behavior. I don't hate the people, but I do hate the behavior.
Pretty strong word. If I'd have had to bet 2 cents, I don't think I would have thought you wouldn't have used it.
It's a difficult word to have to use in a context, but you have to listen to people and try to determine their attitudes, and sometimes people have a complete disregard for the grace of God and a complete neglect of their personal responsibilities. And in that case, you know, when you're dealing with people who are hypocritical, who pass themselves off as being dedicated, consecrated, faithful people, but on the other hand, practice behaviors that are completely inconsistent with the scriptures, that then you have to confront them with that.
All right, let's take a break here. Hold on, Pastor. We got to take a break. We'll be right back.
Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Arnold is our Church of the Week. Jesus says, "My sheep listen to my voice. I know them and they follow me. I give them eternal life." The people of Good Shepherd Arnold invite you to listen to the voice of the Good Shepherd. Sunday worship is at 9 a.m., Sunday school and Bible class at 10:30. They also have an excellent preschool for children 2 years old to pre-kindergarten. Their address in Arnold, 2211 Tenbrook Road. The telephone, 636-296-1292.
Hi, I'm Pastor Doug Nicely. Have you ever been found asleep at the wheel? Personally, I'm thankful for the people who yelled at me and woke me up. Here's a New Testament version of the same thing. Take care, brothers, lest there be in any of us an evil, unbelieving heart leading you to fall away from the living God. We'll describe being asleep at the wheel in this sense this week on In His Steps.
Listen to In His Steps, Saturday at noon with Pastor Doug Nicely on AM 850 KFUO.
An animal that walks on water. Learn about it next on today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moment's host, Ian Taylor.
Would you like to be able to walk on water the way Jesus did? The closest human beings have come to walking on water is water skiing, which some even do without the skis, but they still need a powerful and noisy powerboat to do it. But there is an animal that can walk on water without help of any kind. The basilisk lizard is yet another tribute to God's unlimited creativity, knowledge and power, and this enables him to accomplish his every purpose. The basilisk is equally at home in the trees, on the ground, and in and on the water. It is an excellent climber, and it can outrun any enemy on the ground. Since its back legs are proportionately longer than its front legs, when it needs extra speed, it can just run on its back legs. It runs so fast that it can run across the surface of a body of water that's up to 100 feet wide. That's impressive for a little creature that can reach over 2 feet in length. Skin flaps on both sides of its back toes, as well as its scale fringes on the toes, help the basilisk to stay on the surface. Should the basilisk run into danger while crossing in the water? It sinks beneath the surface and either swims or runs along the bottom in different directions. The lizard is able to stay underwater for several hours. While the basilisk method of walking on water is different from our Lord's, its abilities come from the same God. This lizard shows the wisdom and power of God to do things that seem impossible to us, including giving forgiveness of sins and eternal life to us through his Son, Jesus Christ.
For a free copy of our Creation Resource Catalog, visit our website at creationmoments.com or call us toll-free at 1-800-42-BIBLE. And be sure to join us next time for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
Want to nail down your own free copy of the new Lutheran Study Bible? Well, listen for Luther hammering the 95 Theses to the church door at Wittenberg. That'll be your cue to call 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727 and register for one of several new Lutheran Study Bibles from Concordia Publishing House to be given away on KFUO Radio Friday, October 30th, just in time for Reformation Day weekend. In fact, three of our grand prize drawings will include the Treasury of Daily Prayer along with the new Lutheran Study Bible from CPH. So visit the KFUO.org homepage and register via email. Or listen for Luther's Hammer and call us with your name and number. One registration per household, please. Listen for Luther and nail down your free copy of the new Lutheran Study Bible on KFUO Radio.
You're certainly welcome to come on board here if you like. With a question or a comment in our Ask the Pastor Hour, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our guest is Pastor Alan Shade. He's with us on the telephone today from Emmanuel Lutheran Church in St. Charles. And I'm going to change the subject here, Pastor, unless you have any other thoughts on the 10 Things I Hate About Christianity book.
I was just curious what the 10 were.
Well, I don't have that before me. All I have is the, but we could probably Google that and find that out. Maybe I'll see if I can come up with that here. Let me turn the page to this story here from Raleigh, North Carolina. From the Associated Press, convicted sex offenders are challenging laws that prevent them from attending churches that also operate daycare centers or nurseries during worship services. A convicted sex offender is challenging North Carolina's law. A similar challenge is now pending in Georgia. At issue is whether the constitutional right to religious freedom conflicts with the state goal of protecting the public from child molesters. Sex offender advocates agree some convicts should not be allowed around children, but they contend barring all offenders denies them support needed to become productive citizens. 36 states establish zones where sex offenders cannot live or visit. Some states provide exemptions for churches, but many do not. Church leaders feel caught, between leading houses of worship where broken people can seek help and preventing criminals from exploiting a place of trust. This is one of those train wreck kind of questions here, Pastor. Is this? Do you have an opinion on this?
It is a sensitive area because we're in a situation at Emmanuel where we operate a day school and we have an early childhood center. So those laws impact, and we have to operate with the restriction of a certain amount of distance that a person that is a convicted sex offender cannot come within during normal school normal day school hours and operation activities of the school. But then on the weekend, when we shift to being church, then you have a different set of guidelines that operate, because a person that has that status should be able to worship. Then you usually get into a situation where there are parameters that have to be set out to protect both the worshipers and the individual, and you implement those to make sure that they have access to worship so that they can do so for their spiritual well-being.
So is there a pressure here that you feel as a pastor, as the senior pastor at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in St. Charles? How do you resolve the tension between loving your neighbor, even if that person happens to be a sex offender, and loving your neighbor, that person in your congregation, that innocent person in your congregation who might be at risk? How do you sort that out?
Loving the neighbor, and let's start with the offender, I guess, in the sense that when you love that person, that does not, A, deny the consequences of their actions, and that they have to live with those consequences. So that, you know, if you jump off the Empire State Building and you hit the bottom, you really, it's very difficult to blame the city of New York for having a street there. So when a person commits an offense of that nature, and there are consequences of the laws, even if they didn't know about them or anticipate them, or they come back to create havoc for them in the future, they have committed a violation of a law, and we are citizens of the land, and we're faithful, you know, law-upholding citizens of the land, so we have to live with that. So you have to work within the areas of consequence, and occasionally you may have to change a chart, in a challenge a particular decision on the part of those who are entrusted with implementing the law, or where the law was put together. Some of these laws have been put together in a hurry and not well thought through, so you have other ramifications that don't come to light right away, and then when they do, you have to work to alter them as best you can and live with the circumstances in the meantime. So, but, you know, we live in both worlds. It's not a sense where we can just pretend that these things did not take place, and that's part of a holistic attitude toward the individual.
Well, as you try to sort out those challenges in the kingdom of the right over there in the church, do you worry about your own personal liability in the kingdom of the left? If you should show love and grace to an offender because you've come to know that person and you believe that they can be trusted, and then something goes wrong, uh-oh.
Well, those are the realities that you work with, and that you know, as a pastor or as a staff member or as a worker in the kind of situation, we at times have to consult the law to know exactly what we can and cannot do, and we have to be guided by that. You know, we are not a church body that says, well, if we think the law is wrong, we're free to ignore what the law says. That is not in any sense a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod kind of position, or as far as I'm concerned, it's not a biblical position. So I can't just ignore the laws and say they shouldn't apply, or I can circumvent the law or ignore the law if I want an exception for a particular person. And I don't know that I really do any favors for the perpetrator or the person with that kind of record if we would suggest circumventing you know, that our advocacy for that person would be based on portraying him as the victim in the circumstances. You know, he's not really such a bad person. All this shouldn't be happening to him. He's a really nice guy, and ignore the realities of what the law says and what the conviction indicates. So that's just part of the realistic ministry. You know, you face the realities of the situation. You don't try to deny them or change them cover them with rose petals so that the situation is no longer based in reality.
All right, here's another story from the Associated Press, which I thought might elicit an interesting comment from you. This comes from Vatican City, and the story says that African bishops that have been attending a Vatican meeting are speaking out about the election of Barack Obama in divine terms, putting them very much at odds with some of their U.S. counterparts. Archbishop Gabriel Charles Palmer Buckle of Accra, Ghana, says he believes that there was a quote-unquote divine plan behind Obama's election. He said Obama's rise to power is similar to the experiences of the Old Testament figure Joseph, who after being sold into slavery in Egypt ended up becoming a top official. What do you think about interpreting the signs or the events of the day in the context of a divine plan?
This one is a nice place to crawl out on a limb and hand 45 people a saw. Now, if you want to just look strictly at divine plans, it was also a divine plan that raised up the king of Assyria to invade and haul off the 10 northern tribes. It was a divine plan to raise up Nebuchadnezzar and haul off the two tribes from Jerusalem and Benjamin area, Judea and Benjamin, to go into the Babylonian captivity. Then another plan to raise up Darius so that they could be set free. So yes, and it was a divine plan to put Caesar Augustus in charge of the Roman Empire so that the gospel could be freely proclaimed. But also there are numerous passages in the Old Testament that said, well, God raised up that king, and then when he was finished with him, he dumped him, and he didn't fail to hold him accountable for his idolatry, even though he was a part of raising him up at the right time to use him and then dispose of him when he no longer served his purposes and he turned out to be an idolater. So, you know, it's dangerous to just kind of throw that language around. It sounds more like what they're doing is painting him as some sort of new messianic figure. Joseph is a messianic figure for the rescue of Christ for his people. And now this person is supposedly some kind of new messianic figure that's an ongoing portrait of something in the gospel themes of the New Testament that is so far beyond biblical foundations that I would have to agree with the Vatican brothers who thought they stepped over the line.
Would you say that if we were willing to agree that the election of Barack Obama to president is evidence of a divine plan, then we would most certainly have to also agree that the election of George W. Bush or William Jefferson Clinton or any of our elected officials are part of a divine plan.
I'm not sure if it's completely in line with Scripture, but I appreciate the thought that often says sometimes we get the president or the governor or the mayor or whatever elected official that we deserve, and not that he's a great person, but that we're being punished. So, you know, there were times I'm sure we could come up with moments in anybody's presidency from George Washington to the present day where people would have identified his role as being in a punisher of evil, that were being punished for past sins. That kind of thing is a subjective judgment that people will use depending on their politics. I think I can see the emotions that could enter into this. If you want to look at issues of slavery and the mishandling of the history of slavery among American supposedly Christian people who made some pretty poor judgments about that issue, and that the emergence of someone who with black background and black ethnic identity is a response to that, and maybe that is a way of reminding people of the United States that we have that sore spot in our history that's not completely gone away, and that racism still lives in too many hearts in an American society. If you want to bring that dimension out and say that there is a way of God using this as a time for people to have to think about that, reevaluate that, or reconsider to what extent that we still have an unresolved issue, I could make that application, but the messianic images just trouble me enormously.
All right, if you have your Bible handy there, I'm going to be reading from Amos chapter 5. This is a text that some people may hear in church this weekend. And I have a specific question as it pertains to Amos 5, verses 6 and following, because one of the things that I like to do, one of the hobbies that I engage in is amateur astronomy. So I'm pretty much familiar with the locations of the stars in the sky. I know the names of most of the first magnitude, the brightest stars in the sky, and I know all the constellations. I could do a sky tour for you sometime, Pastor, if you wanted to have something like that.
I could be interested in that.
Well, I've always assumed that constellations and star names are all man-made things. But in Amos chapter 5, and the reading that we have before us, it says, "Seek the Lord and live, or he will sweep through the house of Joseph like a fire. It will devour, and Bethel will have no one to quench it. You who turn justice into bitterness and cast righteousness to the ground, he who made the Pleiades and Orion, who turns blackness into dawn and darkness and darkens day into night, who calls for the waters of the sea and pours them out over the face of the land, the Lord is his name. He flashes destruction on the stronghold and brings the fortified city to ruin. You hate the one who reproves in court and despise him who tells the truth." Lots of things to talk about there, but the astronomical references caught my attention. The star cluster, which we call the Pleiades, some people refer to it as the Seven Sisters. It's a little configuration of stars that some people mistake for the Little Dipper sometimes. But it's a cluster of stars in the constellation Taurus. And then the constellation Orion, which is a bright winter constellation, which is prominently featured in this area in January. It sounds as if these things got their names and their identities from God, not from us. Did they?
I don't know that there's enough information in from the background of the book of Amos to say that God actually named them, or Amos was inspired to use them as specific examples. I think in the context, isn't the issue that all of these things are under the preservation and dominion of God, and that is the one who put the stars in the sky and gave them orderly patterns, that we can recognize the movements of the stars and the arrangements of the stars and the centrality of North Star for direction and stuff like that. All that manifests that God is clearly a God of order, a God of power, a God who oversees and has a great dominion. I think it's just thrown in there because, you know, the next line says, "Who turns blackness into dawn," so that we recognize the rotation of the earth for darkness and light. And darkens day into night is the next line. So I think he's just talking about the orderliness of the created world around, maybe like what Paul would have in mind in Romans 1 when he talks about the power and wisdom of God is easily seen from the things that appear.
Well, you know, I think it can be said to be true that God has made many good things, and his creation was exceedingly good when he brought it into being, but Satan has a way of taking those things and perverting them, even ruining them. I think of human sexuality, for example, where you pastors consistently say that human sexuality in the context of marriage, one man and one woman for life, is a great, great gift from God. But we all know how the devil has taken that gift and perverted it and turned it into something dirty. As a matter of fact, so dirty that some people can't even hardly think about it any other way. Now, I'm wondering if God gave the gift of the Pleiades and the gift of Orion and Taurus and maybe Gemini and those constellations of what we call the Zodiac. I wonder if those came from him and men perverted it, inverted it, turned it into a worship of created things rather than the Creator. And so now we call that astrology, and we think that's a very bad thing. But maybe it was there before it was turned into a very bad thing. And again, what we see in the sky in terms of constellations perhaps originated with God. Am I just completely crazy here?
No, I think you're describing the difference between astronomy and astrology. Astronomy is the recognition of the beauty, the complexity, the design that stands behind the universe as we can observe it with naked eye, with telescopes, with fantastic instruments for going vast distances into stars around us. And that God is a God of order, and recognize that those are other signs of it. That you know, if you're a biologist and are a botanist, and you recognize that in living organisms and in living things, that God has created an enormous order. No matter what human beings do to corrupt, to destroy, or pervert, or misuse, it still has its innate design by God, and he kept saying this little phrase in Genesis 1, and God saw it, and it was good. So the stars themselves are a gift of God, and to be received with thanksgiving for all the little indicators that they give about how great a God we have, how wise a God we have, how intricate a God we have, how God is concerned about even the tiniest of details in our lives, like he is with the stars and the birds of the air and the hairs on our head, and always. But your caution is appropriate. Every good gift that God has given, every single one of them, human beings have tried to desecrate, and Satan has tried to turn into a way to alter our relationship with God and substitute the creation for the Creator.
Let's take a telephone call here at the end of this Ask the Pastor Hour and talk with Jim. Hi, Jim. You're on the Bible study.
Good morning, gentlemen. I was just listening to you. Isn't there a Bible verse that says that God knows the number of the stars in heaven and he calls them all by name? And it also says that he's magnified his word above all. So I think it's important that Christian people study their Bibles and learn from their Bibles. I read the King James Version, but I understand the King James Version. There is mistranslations and there is transliterations, which would be better to understand. But the thing about it is God will give you the knowledge and the tools to search these out if you do what he says and study. Because, you know, the word is how we're to live our life. We're to follow God in all things in our life.
Right.
And, you know, the Old Testament says that he hates all false ways. He's a God that hates. And we're to hate all false ways, but we're also to love like he loves.
Let's see what Pastor
That's my
has
comment.
Said. Thanks
Thank
for
you.
The call.
I have to agree with pretty much everything he said. Psalm 147, he determines the number of the stars and he gives to all of them their names. And I'll underscore that he is making the right distinctions between the power of God, the creation of God, and the evil that has corrupted human beings and the sin that has done its damage to nature. But God remains God, and he calls us to be in his image and in his way, and to love as he loves, and to turn away from sin as sin is revolting to him. So. Amen, brother.
Well, based on this conversation we're having here, and at least allowing for the possibility that if God can name the stars and perhaps name the Pleiades and the constellation Orion, I turn to Psalm 19 where it says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge." Now, I guess before, I was inclined to think that what that meant was when you look up and you think about the stars, you got to say, wow, that's really impressive. But,
yep.
but then you're kind of done. But if in the stars there are patterns, constellations, names of stars, things like that, that I think we've at least allowed for discussion here, then maybe there is more coming from the stars than just the majesty of them. What do you think?
I don't want to close the possibility because there are just things that we learn each day, each new year, and stuff that open up things that we never would have thought about before, that are just awesome in terms of helping us to recognize the greatness of God. And I'll say that's one of the wonderful positions we are in as Lutheran Christians, that we love science. We're not afraid of science, or we don't disdain science. We love pure science because it helps us recognize more and more of the phenomenal God that we have, and the mysteries of things that will continue to unfold that we will never quite fully capture. I think I've been influenced by being at the symposium a couple weeks ago at the seminary and the marvelous speakers that they had there. But there's just so much that God is doing that we haven't begun to delve yet. And the more we know, the better I like it, because it portrays for us a marvelous, awesome, powerful, wise God.
Well, then it makes me, we have less than a minute left here, but it makes me consider the fact that there is a constellation identified as a virgin. There is a constellation identified as a lion. There's a constellation identified as a water bearer. And I can make Christian connections to all those things. Now, am I going too far with that, Pastor?
Chuck, there's always the risk that you're going to go too far.
And you know me too well.
I'm going to go too far. And there's a risk that all of us will go too far, and the encouragement and admonition of the brethren encourages us both to stretch and to grow and to be open to growth and to come back to our moorings and stay solid in the Word, because that's our reliable guide.
I think that is excellent advice. Thank you, sir. We appreciate the conversation.
Glad to do it.
All right.
Have a great day. God bless.
Pastor Alan Shade, our guest here on our Bible study conversation here for Ask the Pastor. Tomorrow we'll continue in Luke chapter 18 with Pastor Michael Walder of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville.
Listen to Chuck Rather and guests Monday through Friday at this same time on the Bible study. The Bible study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for the Bible study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of the Bible study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.